1793. July, August, September. Three months in which the machinery of the terror grinds into action.
The Songkhye lot say, we've put you in power, we've got rid of those other guys, what are you going to do for us? We're still under threat from counter-revolutionaries, so what the heck are you going to do?
Toulon hands itself over to the Allies, but is soon under siege.
And what a coup, indeed. This was a remarkable acquisition for the British.
And Allied hopes of making progress against the border fortresses protecting France meet another major setback.
Val Mouden thinks, I can't do anything here. His men are exhausted. They've been fighting for 3 days on and off. They're running short of ammunition. They're in danger of being cut off. And the French show no sign of easing up.
I'm Alexander Stevenson, and this is episode 7 of the Napoleonic Quarterly, covering 3 months in which Napoleon Bonaparte first makes his mark on the revolution. The Napoleonic Quarterly takes the epic conflicts of the 1792 to 1815 period 3 months at a time. And for the 3 months covered by this episode, I'm joined by Charles Esdale and Alexander Mikaparidze to provide expert summaries and analysis. And for the 3 segments for this quarter, I'll be joined by Marisa Linton, Paul DeMay, and none other than Alexander Mikaparidze. So, Alex, we have extra helpings of you in this episode.
Double the dose.
Yes, well, before we get to lots more of Alex, here's a summary of the headline developments in this 3 months. And this is a 3 month period in which the French Revolution shelves its ideals in favour of survival. Revolts are crushed across the country. The Bordeaux uprising collapses in July. Counter-revolutionary forces are attacked in July in Avignon and besieged in Lyon and crushed in Marseille in August. Despite all this, Toulon, the main French naval base on the Mediterranean, rises in revolt in late August when it hands up the city over to the British and their allies in late August. But by the end of this 3 months, they have an energetic young officer commanding the French artillery to reckon with, more on him later. And elsewhere in September, hundreds die in Nantes as the Jacobins take a grisly revenge. All of this is driven by an increasingly determined government in Paris. Robespierre joins the Committee of Public Safety, and the convention declares total war against its enemies, not to mention a levée en masse in which every unmarried Frenchman aged between 18 and 25 becomes liable for immediate military service. Custine, our favourite from episode 4, is guillotined, and the law of suspects is passed, which enables anyone to be arrested, even if they're just suspected of being anti-republican. What is going to become known as the Terror is well underway. And at the same time, there's a war on too. On the Rhine, the French lose Mainz, and in Flanders, the French lose Condé in July, before the Duke of York besieges Dunkirk. But the French defeat the Allied forces at Honshut, and the Duke of York is forced to raise the siege. In the Pyrenean campaign, the Spanish are repulsed at Perpignan in mid-July, but then see off a French effort to push them back across the Pyrenees in September, Trias. And on Saint-Domingue in the Caribbean, Toussaint Louverture becomes a general in the Spanish army, commanding 4,000 men. And Sontenax, the French commissioner, unilaterally abolishes slavery in northern Saint-Domingue in August. Now, we're going to get into the details of all of this later on in this episode, but there's so much going on to talk about, and I suppose, Alex, I want to quickly come to you and ask whether you think any progress has been made from the point of view of the Montagnards during this period. You were saying in the last episode that what they really needed was Danton's audacity, 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 and the fatherland will be saved. But have they actually put in place any structural changes needed to win the war?
They are beginning to. In that respect, August of 1793 is indeed, or July-August is indeed a crucial moment, since the gradual, this rapid radicalization of the French, or specifically Parisian politics, and the arrival of the Montagnards, the more determined individuals who were ready to sacrifice their idealism and their revolutionary principles for the pragmatic results, leads indeed to the development of a structure that, not immediately, but down the road, will allow the French to prevail. So when we talk about institutions like levee en masse, they are indeed introduced in August, but we oftentimes imagine that levee en masse immediately produces results. It will take months for that to reverberate, but by 1794, the system already will be set up and working to allow the French an upper hand in this conflict.
And Charles, you were talking in the last episode about the French needing allies elsewhere and about the possibility of revolt not necessarily materialising. Is there any good news from the French point of view in this period from what's going on elsewhere in Europe?
The short answer is no. The slightly longer answer is that here and there across Europe, in Bohemia, for example, there are, for example, some instances of peasant unrest, which appear to have been sparked off by news of the French Revolution. But to be frank, it's not worth a row of beans. To all intents and purposes, the French are on their own. The idea of Europe rising in revolt is a complete and total pipe dream. Now, the other thing that I would say, going back to American Alex's point about the levee en masse not taking effect for a long while. Yes, well, eventually it did take effect, but one thing that has to be said is that it takes effect against tremendous resistance. The conscription measure in the decree of conscription in 1793 had been hated everywhere, and the decree of the levee en masse is no different.
This 3 months from the point of view of the Allies, from the point of view of Britain, of Austria, of Prussia, is this 3 months in which the war has gone well for them or not?
I think the short answer is yes, it's gone well, but it's not gone well enough. The balance is a bit mixed, but on the whole, the war can't be perceived to be going badly.
Okay, so this is a strange quarter to my mind because you've got some really big developments in the revolution itself. You do have the fighting on the front line in the Pyrenees and most notably in Flanders. But then you do have this great conflict within France itself. I mean, this is a period when an army is given... Kellerman's given, I think, 100,000 men to deal with what's going on inside France. It's really strange situation I think we're in here. Strange is the wrong word, isn't it? It's brutal.
It is, absolutely. And that's, I think, one of the crucial reasons why the Montagnards decide to embark on setting up a system that was so ruthless and so dismissive of really of human life. Because for them, the stakes in the summer of 1793... the stakes of liberty or death, the way they perceived it, was that the net to ensnare the enemies of revolution inside and the walls, right, the bastions needed to contain the enemies from outside had to be maintained at all costs.
There's a further development that we should perhaps talk about in terms of what American Alex has just been saying about the establishment of the institutions and the legislation of terror. Underpinning this is a really, really evil and vicious doctrine, which sometimes I think goes by the board. It's not necessarily picked up. Essentially, it's this. The French Revolution, the precepts of the French Revolution, are the work of reason. They are the product of human reason. Reason, meanwhile, is the proof of humanity. This is a more secular age. Humanity is not defined by the possession of the soul. Humanity is defined by the process of reason. If you reject the French Revolution, if you resist the French Revolution, you are resisting the workings of reason. If you resist the workings of reason, you are putting yourself beyond the pale of humanity. Consequently, you are no longer human. You are inhuman. You cannot be human if you resist the dictates of reason. And the result is that you have a blueprint for not just political terror, but for extermination. And when I explain this to my students, I always make the point that actually you can draw a direct line from the French Revolution to democracy, yes. You can also draw a direct line from the French Revolution to fascism.
Thank you, Charles. I think that is the perfect way to segue into our first interview, in which Professor Marisa Linton of Kingston University is going to explain the developments in Paris during this three-month period. I began by asking her about the Committee of Public Safety and how that developed, a key organ which is going to drive what becomes known as the terror.
The 12 members, they are subject to re-election each month, and every decree that they put forward has to be voted for by the convention. That's really important, because when you think about what the terror is, it's not just something that Robespierre does. It's a collective thing, and it's done very much under pressure of war and civil war and fear.
Okay, so you have the apparatus, as it were, and this increasingly fevered political atmosphere with the war, the economic pressures. But what actually creates what became known as the terror in September?
I have an issue with this sort of neat chronology of the terror. I've actually written a book about this recently. Yes.
Oh, really? No, I like everything to be nice and simple, please. It's just the ex-journalist in me wanting. Let's really simplify this. Yeah, no, go on. Yes, go on.
But the problem with calling it the terror is that it presupposes that we all agreed on what it is, that it was a system, that a few people were organizing it, that other people weren't involved, that it began on a certain date and ended on a certain date. And actually, the whole thing is much messier, more chaotic, more improvised than that. So as I said, and the principal decree under which people died is actually that decree of 19th of March, Hors-la-Loi, that Hors-la-Loi decree, which is passed before September, obviously. So I think you have to bear that in mind. It's a gradual process by a series of steps. However, September certainly is important. There's pressure put on the mountain by the sans-culottes, because the sans-culottes say, we've put you in power, we've got rid of those other guys, what are you going to do for us? You know, we're still suffering, there are still too many traitors, we still can't afford basic foodstuffs, that we're still under threat from counter-revolutionaries, so what the heck are you going to do? The mountain had been very instrumental in the passing of a new constitution, June 1793, a beautiful libertarian egalitarian constitution. Definitely recommend that people out take a look at that. They pass it, but then they shelve it, because they, as they argue in October, the government should be revolutionary until the peace. So what they're saying there is that a wartime government can't enact all these liberal measures. We have to do certain things because we're at war, and this is a temporary situation. What they call a government of exception, an exceptional government, that's what they call it. So September certainly sees some exceptional measures. There are pressure from the sans-culottes to demonstrate within the convention and say you must take greater measures. Under that pressure, they pass the law of the maximum, which is to control food prices. In fact, the only thing that they really, really regulate is the price of grain, and therefore of bread. That they do control. And they do make efforts for other things, but they're less successful. So that's incredibly important. Again, this is something that benefits Parisians, sans-culottes especially. It's not necessarily the whole of France.
And then, of course, you have the law of suspects.
And this is a nasty piece of legislation. It's very vague. It's very draconian. Anyone who is suspected of not being a good citizen, which could cover just about anybody in any given circumstances, who cannot give a good account of themselves, who cannot get their certificate of good citizenship from the local watch committee. If they can't get that and like prove it, then they can be subject to arrest.
I mean, we're so used to it through the 20th century, understanding, 1984, etc. We know the sort of territory, the thought police territory we're getting into here. But at the time, was this something new to have something so broad and sinister?
In that political sense, in the way in which it was operating, yes. I mean, certainly there have been oppressive regimes before, very oppressive ones.
Yes.
But this was different in the sense of the politics behind it was articulated differently. It's about how people talk about what they're doing. It's not the killing that's new. There's a lot of killing going on. I mean, we now know that an awful lot more killing went on in the American Revolution than was previously thought. You know, there is not, the killing is not, unfortunately, the unusual thing. It's the articulation of it, that it's to support a regime that is essentially democratic, that is run on behalf of the people. Yeah, that aspect of it, yes, is new. But I don't think you can take similarities too far between what happens in France in 1793 and what happens in the 20th century. There are huge, huge differences as well.
Yeah, and actually it was only really kicking off in September. According to my stupidly arbitrary episode plan, we must stop. We cannot possibly talk about anything beyond September 30th. But actually it's really beyond then that the purge starts. Is that about right?
Well, it depends what killing you're talking about.
Yes. No, I think I meant Robespierre saying it's time to purge some of these factions and deal with them all.
Yeah, but it's, the Vendée is important because that's where most people actually die. And they think in total, I mean, right. It's not clear. It's very much disputed by historians. But perhaps 200,000 people die on both sides in that fighting, in the conflict in the Vendée. It's a massive number of people. The total number of people guillotined in Paris, and I can't remember the figure, but it's something like 2,700 and something in total. So it's much, much smaller. I mean, that's not horrible, but it depends what killing you're concerned about. And ironically, people remember the killing of aristocrats, particularly by guillotine in Paris. They remember that much more than peasants killed in the Vendée. It's more memorable. It's more dramatic. It's more Scarlet Pimpernel. And so people know that. Yeah, it's ironic. It's ironic.
Marisa Linton there, and once again, we have this shift away from Paris in terms of where the emphasis is being placed and towards the situation in the rest of France, away from the capital, in terms of the suffering and the impact of the revolution. That's what's really going on here. But let's turn to the Vendée in a second. But first, Alex, what would you say about the situation in Paris during this 3 months?
The situation is very tense for a number of reasons. On a positive side, the Federalists were never able to muster a sufficiently powerful military force to pose a serious threat to the revolution in Paris. So that allows the revolutionaries to mobilize forces, those now revolutionary armies, and go after the isolated centers of the Federalist rebellion at Lyon, at Marseille, at Toulon, as we'll see shortly. But inside Paris itself, here we see, as Marisa has outlined, both the exciting news of the new constitution and the new guarantees of the rights of man and the citizen, That includes social rights, that includes the greater popular controls over the assembly. All these are the great kind of promises of a democratic political process. And yet, for all these promises, there is also this great, consequential decision of putting all of this on hold. That despite all the constitutional guarantees that the Montagnards lay out, none of it will be implemented. And therefore, for a citizen, whether in Paris or not, the constitutional protections are not applicable. So if you are living in or around Paris, you are the epicenter of this maelstrom. And therefore, you can be caught in the politics of the day very easily. And the politics become ever more radicalized because the wider situation of war means that we have both sweeping government measures to win the civil war and foreign war, but also to suppress internal resistance of any sorts. And I think Charles was absolutely right when he talked about this narrative of that all of this is rationalized, and any resistance to it, therefore, should be stamped out as irrational.
Well, Charles, let's ask you about that and turn our attention to the Vendée and elsewhere. Because, okay, I hear what you have said in this episode so far about the evil of the French Revolution and what was going on here. And this is a period in which there are some pretty grisly deaths, many, many grisly deaths. But just from the purely political point of view, if you are someone like Robespierre, are these actions necessary in order to ensure the survival of the revolution?
He and his colleagues would have said so.
But is it a question of pragmatism? Did they feel like they had a choice?
I mean, they certainly did. I mean, they certainly felt that they had a choice, but the choice was quite stark. The choice was between liberty and death, as far as they were concerned.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a Manichaean kind of vision. It doesn't leave any much of a space of between black and white. There is not much of a gray there. You either prevail and protect the revolution and all that it stands for. And that's where you talked about the evils of revolution. But if I may disagree here, is that in the sense that the revolution promises a lot of good things. It's just how those good things can be achieved and protected that is quite interesting, right? That's where the dichotomy is, that the Constitution of 1793 is very progressive and not fully democratic, but quite democratic.
Yeah.
And yet, to protect this democratic gain, to protect the rights and freedoms, we are taking those rights and freedoms and we're beating you with a club.
It also has to be said that terror is not the best way of establishing any regime. Yes, they get through the crisis of 1793 largely because the Allies are not able to take advantage of their opportunities. And that goes back to what I was saying about the French barrier fortresses as much as anything. But are the French people genuinely happy with what they get out of the revolution? I mean, the Montagnard regime very quickly falls apart. What you have is a legacy of embitterment. The French hate being conscripted. They become more and more war weary.
Well, clearly a lot going on in this period, and one of the most significant developments is on the southern coast of France, where Toulon is handed over to the Allies. And Alex, thank you very much for talking us through this. Here's Alexander Micaberidze on what's going on in Toulon.
What we see is in July of 1793, or in general in summer, the bourgeoisie, whether it's Toulonnaise or from Marseille or from Lyon, indeed exploited this mounting discontent with Jacobin policies to win popular majority in the sections, right? Those urban administrative sections, and then turn the tables on their opponents to come to power. And that is quite interesting because they effectively exploit the very mechanism, the electoral mechanism that the Jacobins exploited earlier to use them against. And it is then only after they come to power that we see then a rupture with the central government that soon follows, in the Montagnard or the Jacobin faction, which dominate national convention, vigorously responding to this provincial threat, then leaving not much for the local authorities in Marseille, in Lyon, and finally Toulon, to do, but to defend themselves through a variety of measures. In Lyon and Marseille, especially in Lyon, you have an all-out violent right struggle where that required an all-out siege of Lyon by the Army of Alps, right, with Kellerman and others to get there. And at Toulon, the prospect of this then results to a very different outcome, the astonishing betrayal that I would argue was entirely unforeseen by the very anti-Jacobin forces that staged that in the municipal revolution 6 weeks earlier in Toulon. No one came to power in Toulon expecting to betray the nation and give the city to the British. So the royalist element in here is very small.
Is that right? So that's really interesting, because I think there is this assumption that, you know, it was just a straightforward revolt against the government, the national government in Paris. So let's just quickly cover off the chronology then. How did things develop in the run up to the great well, I was going to say revolt, but the decision to turn against the direction that Paris was heading in.
So if we look at the conditions in Toulon, well, in the spring of 1793, we see deteriorating economic conditions. And what we see is that in the spring of 93, in Toulon and many other areas, the cost of bread doubled, increasing to 6 sols a pound. Now, we know that there were disturbances in the cities outside the baker shops as people were complaining about the cost, rising cost of food. And we know that at least one individual was arrested in Toulon for proudly declaring that we need a king back, because under the king, bread was cheaper. So you see here the more economic consideration driving the disturbance. And of course, the second major problem that is related to this economic reality is, of course, depreciation of the assignat. Now, many retailers in Marseille, in Toulon, in Lyon, and other places were simply unwilling to take paper money. And we have this black market in hard cash flourishing. But of course, in black market, the costs of items, of food, and other stuff is much higher. And what we see then is that even the sans-culottes, who traditionally are perceived as a base over the Jacobins, even the sans-culottes in Toulon preferred being paid in cash rather than assignat, and this inability to be paid in money that you can actually trust or rely on is quite frustrating. And what is interesting to me is that these sans-culottes actually had throughout 1793 up to the surrender of the city, had actually gotten some of concessions. For example, in January, they got a salary increase of 30%. Then later on in the spring, they had further salary increase of 110%.
Really? I would be prepared to accept that.
But will you accept it even if the prices are going high and the money is losing its value?
Yes, true. So this is a hyperinflation situation.
Right. And so even the doubling, virtual doubling of their pay left this man highly dissatisfied and therefore exposed to a rhetoric of the local bourgeoisie, who was more moderate in its revolutionary outlook and more willing, right, to explore the environment or this economic environment to come back to power and set the agenda.
Okay, so as always, the price of bread is not far away from what's actually driving the situation here. What about if we look at it through the military lens? You've got General Carteau sent to deal with Avignon. Kellerman's siege of Lyon is underway. What are the prospects for these cities and towns holding out against the will of the Jacobins?
Indeed. And in that sense, summer is a crucial moment because here we see this attempt, a failed attempt, but nonetheless in July, when the hopes were running high that the Montagnards in Paris were about to be defeated. Of course, it's a misplaced hopes, but nonetheless, their hopes that Montagnards will be defeated and that the new National Assembly would be created. And what we see is that from many parts of the South, we see volunteers who are setting out to march on the capital. Effectively, you will have here a repeat of the summer of 1792. And they were joined by the contingent, by a number of soldiers or volunteers from Toulon. And together, these new kind of reinvented fédéré units, right, these volunteer units, are marching up the Rhône River. The goal is to relieve Lyon, which is being besieged, and eventually to go to Paris.
Right.
Of course, these Provençal forces never made it that far. They are scarcely penetrated beyond Avignon when they are confronted by the Revolutionary Army and they beat a hasty and rather disorganized retreat.
They run away.
which allows Carteau to occupy in August, recapture Marseille a few days later, and Toulon is then next on this target list. And the people in Toulon, of course, understand what will happen. They know what happened what is happening in Lyon, in Marseille. And so Toulon is therefore, once again, this isolated. It's full of refugees from these cities who tell the stories of reprisals. There is a considerable concern of what will happen when the revolutionaries will arrive.
Okay, I'd never quite grasped that, actually, that, this was the last bastion, really, that essentially all these other places were falling. They were seeing the retribution that was being dealt out in these places that had attempted to resist and then that had been very much crushed. So this was really the last hope for these places. But at the same time, they could very much see what was coming.
Indeed, and especially now, if we know that Toulon was ringed by fortifications, and we know that it had considerable military resources, and in another kind of environment, I think they would have had hope of prolonged resistance. But here we have a combination of factors that made this impossible. To start with, we have the British coastal blockade. Then we have the already worsening economic conditions in Toulon itself. Then we have the flood of fugitives. Depending on the study, you'll see that as many as 50,000, inhabitants, the garrison, the flood of fugitives, all of them are now crammed in this city. And therefore, there is a great pressure on the available supplies. Right. So the city knew, the leaders knew that even the most generous outcome, the city may have survived with existing supplies for about 7 to 8 weeks. So the confrontation was forthcoming. And as you said, this is a last little bastion for the moderate survivors of the South. And Carteau is coming. So you have to decide. Are you going to die of hunger? Are you going to submit to the Revolutionary Army and suffer the consequences, or you will find a third option?
Well, it was on the 27th of August that the city was essentially not handed over, but there was this appeal to the British. And I suppose clearly what was driving that was this choice that actually at least then, they could receive the support from the British. And this would potentially give them an opportunity of, as you say, surviving for longer than 8 weeks or so.
Indeed, if you look how these negotiations unfolded, it's quite interesting because initially it's the refugees from Marseille who've come to Toulon who suggest reaching out to Lord Hood, right, who was in command of the British fleet of the coastline of Toulon, to reach out to him with a request for free passage of grain. So you see here, the first outreach is about food. It's about food safety. Negotiations continued for a day or so around August 20th. And then, of course, it continued, but already within a different context, and that the context being that Marseille is lost and the Revolutionary Army of Carteau is about to approach. And so what the Marseillaise negotiators suggested was that Hood should go ahead and offer an alliance to the Toulonese, which he did on August 23rd, declaring that he and the British Navy would defend the town on the condition that the Republic was renounced in favor of the monarchy and that all military installations were entrusted to the British. And so what we see, therefore, is this great act of betrayal from the French point of view or the revolutionary point of view. This great day act of betrayal originated in this very haphazard, very, fast moving situation.
So they were pushed into it by events.
That's
really.
Right. There is no contrived plot, neither on the part of the British, nor on the part of the counter-revolutionary agents, or however you want to style them.
But what a coup for the British to suddenly have not just the primary French naval base in the Mediterranean, but also the French fleet falls into their hands as well.
And what a coup, indeed. This was a remarkable acquisition for the British, because Toulon was the key naval arsenal. So aside from the ships themselves, we all talk about the supplies, the logistics that sustained this the naval force on the sea, all that would have been fallen in the British hands, alongside of more than two dozen ships of the line and other warships that Toulon at the time had. So from the Lord Hood's point of view, he effectively was killing two birds with one stone.
Well, Alex, that's Alexander Micheberidze talking through the situation there. What did you make of Alex? How did he do?
He was completely wrong.
well, one thing we deliberately left out or didn't play much of in this interview was the question of Napoleon Bonaparte, who and this is a deliberate editorial decision of this podcast. He's we're kind of trying to take things as things happen, and the fact is that he was one of many at this time. Clearly that will change, spoilers, but for now this is quite a significant moment because it's the moment when he is appointed to command the artillery who are going to try and recapture Toulon and play a critical role. So maybe now is a good moment to start to get to know this young man, Napoleon Bonaparte, who Charles publishes a pamphlet in July, which is an attempt to try and get himself noticed. Could you have a go at summing up who Bonaparte is, or what he had become by the summer of 1793?
Napoleon Bonaparte is one of the most written about figures in modern times. Very briefly, he's born in Corsica in 1769. His family... although his family had previously been engaged in resistance against the Genoese and then against the French, his family turned collaborator. He is sent off to France to receive a military education, goes to two military schools in France, then goes on to the General Military Academy. So he gets a very good military education, becomes an artillery officer. But he's an artillery officer who spends almost no time in the army. This is prior to the revolution, incidentally. He's commissioned in 1788. Spends almost no time with his regiment, which is, I believe, garrisoned at Valence in southern France. Spends all his time on leave in Corsica.
So we've got a very interesting young man with a background in Corsica, which is not the most quiet of places, against the backdrop of the revolution. How is he navigating these twin challenges?
First of all, what is Bonaparte interested in above all else? It is the advancement of his own interests and those of the Bonaparte family. Secondly, he sees the revolution as an opportunity to advance the cause of Corsican independence. He sees himself as using the revolution to sort of free Corsica of France's shackles, declare an independent state with himself as its saviour and liberator. And he engages in a whole series of very complicated machinations in terms of Corsican politics. Very factional, very family-based, a lot of manoeuvre, a lot of intrigue, which we won't go into.
But good practice for what's to come.
Good practice for what's to come, very Machiavellian. But it all comes apart at the seams in the spring of 1793. Essentially, Napoleon overplays his hand. His opponents gang up on him and his family. And he and his numerous family, he, of course, his mother's still alive, but he has a whole troop of brothers and sisters. And they get in a small boat, flee to France. Napoleon arrives in France, and he undergoes a metamorphosis.
Oh, really?
Yes.
You'd go that far?
Yes. He arrives in France a Corsican patriot, but Corsica has rejected him. So Napoleon immediately drops all the nonsense about Corsica. He stays loyal to his basic interest, which is Napoleon, and promotion of his own interests and those of his family. To do that, he plugs himself in to what he perceives as the dominant political force in France. And he does that by writing a ultra-radical pamphlet called Le Souper de Beaucaire, in which he engages in this discussion with somebody who doesn't like what's going on, and he puts them to rights. And so that's how he makes his name. Then, of course, he turns up at Toulon, and the he's able to put himself forward as somebody who could be trusted. You know, he's loyal to Robespierre, Committee of Public Safety, and he's young, he's dynamic, and all the rest of it. And that's where he bursts on the scene.
I do want to point out that it's not just about Napoleon kind of personal opportunism, but it's also the stark reality that Corsica rejected him for a number of reasons. Now, he was a great fan of Pasquale Paoli, the Corsican leader.
Yeah.
But for Paoli, Bonaparte's were collaborators, as you pointed out. His father, Charles Bonaparte, made a crucial decision to collaborate with the French after resisting the French.
Yeah.
And Paoli never forgave Charles, or, Charles was dead already by this time, but certainly not his children. And Napoleon's efforts to reach out Paoli are rebuffed on this personal level as well.
Yeah.
But they also, you pointed out that he was a nationalist, and he was. And in fact, in 1789, Napoleon's godfather writes in a rather interesting letter that French rule is the, quote, most terrible tyranny imposed by the foreigners, with contemptible customs, contemptible conduct, and, quote, despicable birth. So as of revolution, Napoleon is circulating in this milieu of Corsican nationalists. But the revolution turns him around in some respect. Now, we can argue whether this Napoleon saw it as a personal opportunism, or whether he genuinely believed that Corsica as an island would have benefited better from the revolutionary changes. But it's also an ideological break that he experiences with Paoli, or the issue of French presence or Corsican independence. And so by 93, that break is clear cut.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with all of that. I mean, Napoleon's always going to be a complex figure. There are any number of ways of looking at him, any number of strands that can be brought out in his character. Yes, he was genuinely a Corsican patriot. He certainly saw himself as that. Yes, at the same time, he actually sympathised with many of the ideals of the revolution. He actually thought the idea of building up a strong state was a good idea. It's very, very difficult to categorise Napoleon. All you can do is put forward a narrative that fits into 1 minute. If you're given 5 minutes, you can put forward a more complex narrative. If you're given a 500-page book, then you could develop a very different Napoleon again.
If I can ask Charles, what do you think about the Sapé Boc Array? Is it an opportunism, or is it a belief that Napoleon had in revolutionary ideals?
This is this pamphlet that was published in July.
The honest truth is that I believe it was political opportunism. Napoleon was certainly not averse to many ideals of the revolution. But one thing which we haven't talked about is the fact that he was present by sheer happenstance as much as anything. He was present in Paris on August 10th, 1792. And he was literally just across the road from the Tuileries when it was stormed. You know, he had a grandstand view. And he was shocked to his very core by what he saw. He was shocked by this vision of the populace on the rampage. He was shocked by the blood and gore. He was shocked at the idea of regular soldiers being set on, even if they were Swiss Guards, you know, being set on and butchered by a mob. It affected his view of the French Revolution very, very deeply. And it was a moment, I think, of disillusionment. And after that, I cannot but feel that Napoleon's engagement with the revolution is much more cynical than it had been before. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm doing a man a disservice, but that really is how it seems to me.
Okay, let's move on to the next segment, which is Paul Demay returning, who's written about the period for Helian Books. We've had 3 months of relative stagnation on the actual front line in Flanders, with the Austrians very interested in besieging fortresses and the British interested in grabbing what they can. Well, in this 3 months, the only thing stagnating is the waters in the flooded fields around Dunkirk. So here's Paul Demay returning to the podcast to set out the state of play. And very interestingly, he's much more upbeat about the Allied prospects here.
At the end of July 1793, the Allied position looks very favourable indeed. Ever since the Austrian victory at Neerwenden in March had basically led to the French being driven out of the Austrian Netherlands, the British, who had come into the war, had been fighting with the Austrians to recover territory. They'd actually got as far as moving into the fortresses in northeast France. And Condé surrendered on 12th July and Valenciennes on the 28th. So on the northern frontier, we've actually got Allied armies on French territory. On the Rhine, the siege of Mainz, which had been going on since April, came to an end on the 23rd of July. You've got the Allies poised to launch aggressive operations on the Rhine as well. So the French are in a pretty dire situation. The British had a long-term ambition to take Dunkirk, and the Austrians, far from wanting to push on to straight on Paris, decided they would go and besiege Le Quesnoy, which was another fortress in northern France. This is not the best idea because Le Quesnoy and Dunkirk are about 90 miles apart. So you've split your army, you've marched to two places 90 miles apart, and in between them there's a thin cordon of about 20,000 Dutch and Austrians. And the French, although they had been, they'd suffered these defeats, they still had about 175,000 men available. They were still a threat if the Allies took too aggressive a stance. I mean, the obvious thing to do is to concentrate their forces and to attack either the Duke of York, who's commanding the Allied forces besieging Dunkirk, or the main Austrian army. And they decided to go for Dunkirk. Well, the Duke marched off towards Dunkirk. And we talk about the siege of Dunkirk. It's a bit of a misnomer because they hadn't asked for any naval support, so they couldn't cut off Dunkirk from the sea. The French controlled the sluices and they were able to flood large parts of the territory in front of Dunkirk. So basically what it amounts to is the Duke of York forms a line to the east of Dunkirk. He hasn't got any siege artillery, by the way, because he'd requested that, but it hadn't arrived yet.
Oh dear, yeah.
So he's got no siege artillery.
Oh no, yeah. So he's just hanging around outside, really.
To be honest, not much more than that. Now, to be fair, he did summon Dunkirk to surrender, and they basically told him where he could go with that as an idea. But it's the Duke has got, in total, 35,000 men, give or take, and he splits them into two. He can't just... He's trapped in this narrow corridor between the sea and a canal where he's facing off Dunkirk. Because he's worried about the French being able to outflank him, he sends about 16,000 men to protect his left flank. And meanwhile, the French, as I say, have flooded the area.
And is it right to say that the flooding had essentially almost not trapped the Duke of York, but he was in a strip of land between the sea and the flooded area, which meant that his actual room for manoeuvre was quite restricted?
He's got no... He's basically... we shouldn't get too excited about Dunkirk as a fortress. It was a pretty mediocre fortress. But he can't cut it off from supply. He can't really do very much without heavy guns, other than stand there and sort of posture a bit. In the meantime, although Freytag's job is to protect the Duke's army, he got it into his head that he could undertake offensive operations. And he got as far as Berg. He drives in quite a few little French outposts, but then he adopts this nice cordon. He's got his 16,000 men spread out in over a front of about 24 miles. So as you can see, the Duke of York's position is pretty poor.
So he ought to be finished off by the French, really.
The French had a new commander, Houchard, who essentially was a brave and experienced officer. I mean, we shouldn't get away from that. He had been one of Custine's most effective subordinates in the Rhine campaign. But he was no army commander, and he knew he wasn't. He was also a little bit disheartened by the fact that his former boss, Custine, had been sent to the guillotine.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, isn't it?
He's got two representatives of the people watching his every move. Houchard, then, is in this position where he's in command of an army that he knows he's not up to the job, really. But he's under a lot of pressure from the government to get the British away from Dunkirk, to raise the siege. And he's got to decide what to do. They can either do a direct attack on the Duke of York's army, or they can go for Freytag and drive him away, and in that way expose the Duke's flank and force him to retreat. They decide on the latter, but he puts together a strike force of just short of 46,000 men, which, when you think the Duke in total has got 35 and they're spread out, as we've described, that is quite an impressive force. And he divides them into six columns to attack. The first attack starts on the 6th of September, and the main column is basically going to try and push back the Hanoverians in front of them. And essentially, although Freytag is able to hold on to his right position, he's forced to give way everywhere else. And so he decides the only thing he can do is fall back, otherwise he'll be cut off and destroyed. So Freytag, basically, on the night of the 6th, is in full retreat. Freytag is rescued, but he's been wounded and he's not in a position to carry on the battle. So his number two, Walmoden, takes over command of that force. And on the 7th, there's a bit more desultory fighting, because the French have advanced a long way, and although they've been able to push in the Allied positions, they're not in great shape either. So they don't do an awful lot on the 7th, but on the 8th they decide now's the time to finish off Walmoden. Walmoden's fallen back to a position that they'd previously identified at Onskut, and he's drawn up his forces in front of that small town. Again, the French decide, rather than try and cut him off or engage in fancy manoeuvres, they will do a frontal attack against his position. And they divide the army up into five columns this time. Things don't go very well for him at all. His troops are inexperienced. They're starting to give ground. And it's even been reported, I mean, this is where it's useful that the representatives of the people are there, because two of them are with him when he's on the verge of wanting to retreat, because he thinks he's already lost the battle, and they tell him that he's got to carry on.
Yeah, so he's doing a full frontal attack, having done the opposite of concentrating his forces. It's not going very well, but his resolve is stiffened artificially by these political advisors who are breathing down his neck.
Exactly, and by the recent experience of generals who hadn't delivered.
Yes, he remembers that. And so what? So how does the battle resolve itself?
Essentially, they formed large columns and attacked with bayonets and drove in the Allied positions. The Allies are starting to run out of ammunition. They only carry enough rounds to fire constantly for a few minutes, less than half an hour, say. And so they're starting to run out of ammunition. They're being attacked by very large numbers of Frenchmen coming at them with bayonets from several directions. And in the end, Walmerden thinks, I can't do anything here. His men are exhausted. They've been fighting for 3 days on and off. They're running short of ammunition. They're in danger of being cut off. And the French show no sign of easing up. So he decides to pull out and fall back.
And that's that. And does that then lead to what had been hoped before, that the Hanoverian withdrawal then prompts the Duke of York to have to abandon his quasi-siege of Dunkirk and fall back along the coast as well?
Exactly so. And what's worse than that is the artillery had eventually arrived, but a lot of the guns he was sent didn't have field carriages. They were on garrison carriages, and they'd have to be brought up by boat.
Oh, no.
So he had to abandon most of his artillery, a large part of his baggage, and basically beat a hasty retreat to avoid being cut off. Just as a small aside, it's perhaps ironic that the British naval squadron that was supposed to be being sent to support him arrived just as he was pulling out of the siege.
Oh, no. So it's all gone a bit wrong.
And then the French, you'd have thought, were on an absolute roll. They didn't really follow up Walmerden because they were worn out. The Hanoverians had put up a pretty solid resistance, and the French were not in great shape to follow up on their victory. Having said that, once they'd recovered, they were able to move on. They captured Menin briefly. They threatened Ypres. There was a serious fear that the ports of Nieuport and Ostend would be captured. And if that had happened, the British had no viable means of supplying their army in Flanders. It persuaded the government to send 8 regiments of infantry, which was a lot more than the Duke of York had, British infantry, to protect Ostend. So it delayed. They had been intended for Sir Charles Grey's expedition to the West Indies. It had to be sent to shore up the position. But gradually the situation was stabilised. Menin was recaptured. The other towns that I've mentioned, although threatened, didn't fall. They weren't in a good position in the Duke's sector, but they'd stabilised it at least. And in the aftermath, Houchard was followed Custine to the guillotine.
Oh no, another one bites the dust.
He was arrested on the 20th of September, and he was accused of all sorts of things, including cowardice. Now, you could say he was indecisive, you could say he didn't push his advantages to the full, but he certainly wasn't a traitor, and he certainly wasn't a coward. I mean, at his trial, in a sort of quite a theatrical gesture, he sort of ripped off his shirt and showed all the wounds that he'd suffered in the French army. And unlike Custine, he wasn't a noble, so he might not have expected this. But as I say, he paid the price for his inability to do what his political masters thought he should have been able to achieve.
So an awful lot of detail there from Paul Dumais, who's very comprehensive in his approach in explaining what's happened. But I wanted to ask about the tactics here. There are a few points that might be interesting to ask you about. We always get this idea of the French running ahead with their flags, the skirmisher clouds in front. Is that about right?
Well, to a degree, there is truth in it. We see them using... making lavish use of columns on the battlefield, in other words, blocks of troops which can move very rapidly and hurl themselves upon the enemy. We also see him making use of skirmishers, and on Hoot is often seen as a battle in which French skirmishers overwhelm the old-style troops of the Ancien Régime. Well, true and false. Anchute was a very, very cluttered, broken battlefield, lots of woods, hedges, small villages, and large-scale tactics of the traditional Ancien Régime type would not have worked. And what happens, I think, is that the French advance in column and they detach big skirmish screen in front of them and they keep feeding it. So they've always got formed troops in reserve. They simply overwhelm the Allies by force of numbers. But elsewhere, revolutionary tactics clearly don't work at all well. And we need to look at the Spanish frontier. By July, the Spaniards at last got through the Pyrenees. They were held up for ages by the fort at Bellegarde, blocking one of the major passes. They get through the Pyrenees, push forward into Perpignan, into Roussillon, get to Perpignan and try and blockade it. And they're doing rather well. The trouble is, there aren't enough Spaniards. The further they advance, the more overstretched they are. The French pounce on them in July. They catch them overextended, drive them back in considerable disorder, and they retreat towards the Pyrenees and then take up a defensive position. And this is where things get interesting, because the French commander in the area, General Dagobert, decides that he's going to launch an offensive. I mean, he wants to keep his head after all, doesn't want to get guillotined. And he attacks the Spanish army, commanded by a general called Ricardos, at a place called Trilla, on, I think, the River Tet. The French columns go forward in style, with drums beating and colours flying and everybody shouting Vive la Nation and all the rest of it. And they are shot to pieces in short order and routed. And Dagobert withdraws, having lost heavy casualties. And that despite the fact that he outnumbered Ricardos by some 5,000 men. To argue that somehow the French had the secret of military victory, to argue that French tactics were in and of themselves much better than anything the Allies could offer, I think it's just plain wrong.
That does sound like a simplistic approach, which would be quite boring if it was true. I mean, it's very interesting to see how these struggles are often a ding-dong affair. Is that about right, Alex?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, when we look at the situation in the north, and especially involving Jean-Nicolas Houchard, you see how it is also becoming connected to the political events in Paris itself, because Houchard was a fervent patriot. He supported revolution, he supported many of its ideals, and he was also a well-experienced man. He has served in the Royal Army. Right? He was at the Régiment des Royaux Allemands for many years, since he was 16. So by this time, he would have a significant experience. And yet, what we see is this, that after Honshut and Menon, he suffers a setback at Courtrai. Now, one would expect that the general who had won one battle but has suffered a setback in another would have given some slack, and yet he was not. So in here, the political rhetoric in Paris comes to haunt in a bad way Houchard, because he's denounced, and denounced not as a traitor necessarily, but rather denounced for his incompetence. There was nothing aristocratic about Houchard. He rose from the ranks, reached rank of captain after 24 years of service, and yet even this man is denounced as simply not being able of conducting himself in charge of the armies. And so Houchard pays the life, for a failure with his life. But what we see here is that the government in Paris is now expecting not just the political loyalty, but also competence from the commanders. And inability to meet this expectation will be punishable with death.
Well, it feels like Houchard is a case study that shows just the great difficulties of being in France in this period and dealing with these great problems. It almost feels like in this episode and the last episode, so really 1793 so far, at least the 6 months so far, an increasing volume of escalation, tension, and hatred which is making everything more intense and just making it much harder to cope with the situation. It feels like if I was in France right now, at the end of by the end of September, the political intensity, the military intensity, it's just ratcheting up to an utterly unsustainable crescendo. I would sort of, you know, have my hands covering my ears and be screaming by now, I think.
Well, in the United States, we have an expression, hold my beer, in the sense that things are about to get worse. So the next 3 months, if you thought this was bad, just wait until next episode.
Okay, well, let's wrap this episode up by asking you both for your thoughts on what were the big question marks at the end of September 1793. So we've got to where we've got to, not a very happy situation. Is there any way out? What do these various actors need to start to make progress towards their various objective? And perhaps Charles might start with you and ask you that question.
There's two issues. First of all, can the British and in the Mediterranean their allies sustain the course of internal revolt in France? In the Vendée, that means landing substantial numbers of troops, substantial amounts of armaments in what is an increasingly limited window of opportunity. The Mayonnais are marching towards the Vendée. It's now heading into the autumn, Atlantic gales. This is not going to be easy. In Toulon, you've got a situation where a very capable French artillery officer has realised what the weak point of the Allied position is. He understands he can dominate the harbour and blow everything out of the water. Again, how are they going to sustain that? So that's one question. The other question is whether the Allies can keep up the pressure, the military pressure, which they've been exerting.
Well, how well do you feel the Allies were doing by this stage? What would they have needed to do to keep up that pressure in the remaining 3 months of 1793?
The Spanish army in Roussillon would have needed massive reinforcements, but those reinforcements were not forthcoming because the war was not popular in Spain. There weren't very many volunteers. There was conscription. It was being resisted and so forth. And on the northern frontier, again, the Allies were going to need far more troops than they'd had previously, and they were going to have to pick a hole in the French barrier fortresses. They couldn't go anywhere until somehow they had hacked a passage through this chain of multiple fortresses. Could they have done that? If they had been able to do it, well, yeah, they had all sorts of possibilities. I don't believe that they had the capacity to do it.
So that's the military situation. What about the domestic politics of France? Where is this going? Where could it have gone at this stage, Alex?
This quarter marked, in many respects, the beginning of this the crescendo of popular involvement in the revolution as well as a popular opposition to it. What we see at this time is the greater polarization, but also ability to deal with the issues, with the problems that the government, the revolutionary government, is facing. Not just the military situation that Charles so outlined so well, but rather issues that are far more profound of socioeconomic nature. So, for example, the issue of common lands had been very contentious for many people since the very beginning of 1789. To whom do they belong? Could individual families take a share? Or what interests of the rural poor best be secured by keeping them in common? And this is not a trivial issue, right? If you are a commoner, what the revolution can offer you, the great rhetoric of constitutionalism or actual delivery on the issue of who owns the land that you have been renting from other, from your seigneur. And here in July of 93, the constitution tries to dismantle the remnants of the feudal system, because we've talked about previous issues that the events of 89, August 7, 1789, are not dismantling the Well, it's not the end of feudal regime. The feudal regime survives the events of 1789, but here, in starting in July and August of 93, the convention takes deliberate efforts to dismantle the land ownership that is feudal in its nature. And that is quite an interesting element, because it's one of the most ambitious attempts by the revolutionary government to recruit the rural poor, to give them a vested interest in the revolution. And how that plays out, whether they are successful or not, is something we will see in the subsequent episodes.
Charles, what would you say about what's going on in the Vendée in this period?
Right. Well, what you've got is a very, very nasty war, with both sides guilty of atrocities. But the Republicans, for the most part, are kept out. You have this stalemate which has been dragging on since February. The Vendeans can't break out. The Republican forces can't break in. However, you mentioned a little bit earlier the fall of Mainz. Mainz, of course, is a city, you know, right the other side of France. It's not even in France, it's in the Rhineland. And there had been a long siege there, which had been particularly nasty, actually. The Ancien Régime troops surrounding Mainz had basically unleashed a terror bombardment against it and caused terrible damage. The garrison had suffered tremendous privations, very long siege. They're forced to surrender. The French negotiate some very, very interesting terms. Essentially, the garrison will not serve for a year against the foreign enemies of France, and there is nothing to stop it from engaging in operations against domestic insurgency. And it's this force, the so-called Mayennais, they're a tough, battle-hardened force, very, very, very bitter in their view of counter-revolution. They've had a horrible time, and they come back, and they are sent towards the Vendée. They don't quite get there yet. They don't arrive until October, but they're sent to the Vendean front, and they are going to do something about it.
And we'll find out what it is that they're going to do in the next episode. But for now, thank you to Charles Esdale and to Alex Mika-Baridze. Thanks also to Marisa Linton and Paul DeMay. Thanks to Ben Eckersley for the music you've heard. At the end of this quarter, there are 7,930 days to go until Waterloo. And I hope you'll join me for episode 8, when among my guests will be Christy Piquicaro, who will be describing the downward spiral of events in the Caribbean.
The best way to summarize it is to say that this was a moment of utter turmoil. Really, the outcome of all of this was anyone's guess, and no one could have imagined the sea change that awaited in the following year.